Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast and our big post Six Nations debrief with Bernard Jackman and Johnny Holland. Get in touch with us. We want your questions as we head in towards the business end of the club season and the Women's Six Nations as well. sportpodcasts@rte.ie is the email address. That's sportpodcasts@rte.ie. As I said, Bernard Jackman and Johnny Holland are with me. Bernard, you were in Tala yesterday, after Paris on Saturday, two wildly entertaining games. We'll start with Tala, though. Leinster School Senior Cup final. I didn't see any of it. 24 all. Sounds like a cracker by all accounts. Last minute BlackRock try to and conversion to send it to a replay next week.
Yeah, incredible game. BlackRock had a big win, like a huge win in the first half, and had a lead. But Mary's went back in front. Mary's excellent side, both brilliant sides, but the very last play of the game, actually going into injury time, BlackRock go all the way up the field, phase after phase, but putting lots of wit on it, and eventually scored on the left hand side. And Luke Coffey, who's the BlackRock number nine, BlackRock captain, his brother is Oliver Coffey, who's also a number nine in Leinster Academy, and he'd won a cup with BlackRock as captain, and I think he lost one, but Luke was having a chance to win one as captain, and emulate his brother, and he kicked a pressure kick from the wrong side for him. He's a left footer to send it to a replay. Last kick of the game. Huge crowd there. I don't know how many thousand. It was definitely over 10,000.
Somewhere between 8 and 9.
Yeah, it was, and the atmosphere was unbelievable. A huge Mary's crowd. Obviously, Mary's haven't been there for a while. Mary's definitely outsung them, but the replay's on Monday now. But the player who caught the eye is Paul Neary, the Mary's out half. He was outstanding. I mean, he has everything in his game, and he's one of those players that you'd only go pay to see again. So I'm looking forward to seeing him. But there's great players on both sides. And it's interesting, the Munster Schools Cup final is on this afternoon, I think. So, but when you see that game, I've been at a lot of the Senior Cup games and Junior Cup games, there's a lot of quality coming through, to be fair.
There is, yeah. And it's certainly a different looking game to what it would have been the Schools game 10, 15 years ago. Johnny, as Bernard said, the Munster Schools Senior Cup final is on today. Prez Cork against Munchins. Obviously, you're involved with CBC down there as well, so you've got a good look at both of those teams over the year, I imagine. From what I've heard, I haven't seen too much of it whatsoever now, but this PBC team seems to be rocking up all sorts of scores.
Yeah, they're a good side. I mean, like, we took a bit of a beating to them as well, but you know, sometimes things happen on a day, and scores happen. But no, they are a very good side. They've got very good quality individuals, but up front and in the backs, like, but it's the back line that everyone's talking about because they've got Irish schoolboys littered all over it. You know, so I think if it goes the way people expect it to go today, then Prez will have another cup in their trophy. Like, but tell that to St. Munchins because they love the underdog card, don't they? And I think they'll be turning up to really upset them. Like, but you can't look past Prez. Like, they're going to add another one fairly easily to their trophy cabinet.
Yeah, well, there's a few teams there that enjoy being an underdog as much as a good old Munchins team do. I do remember actually 2006, it was Prez against Munchins in the Senior Cup final. It was St. Patrick's Day. I went along to it. It was on in Thomond Park, and it was a star-studded PBC team, but the real star on show was Keith Earls for Munchins, and I don't want to do discredit to that Munchins team, but there was an element of it being like Keith Earls and 40 and others. Now, Conor Murray was on the bench that day as well, a very young Conor Murray as well, but Munchins ground out a very, very famous win that day.
I saw a photograph it came up on my LinkedIn or something yesterday of that team being back together in Munchins this week. And two photographs. And obviously Earlsy stuck out like a sore thumb. But it's great. Look, the same for the lads playing today. Regardless of whether they win or lose, they've done something, you know, significant as a team. And in 10, 20, 30 years' time, there'll be an opportunity to get back together and reflect on it. And some of the lads that have gone on to play for Munster and Ireland, the British and Irish Lions, like Earlsy and others, will have gone to play club rugby, and others won't play again. But it's a special time in schoolboys' lives.
Yeah, I just remembered as you were saying that 2006 was actually 20 years ago, and now I'm starting to feel really, really old at the moment.
Just Earlsy.
That's actual, like, Kieran Regan is the SNC coach in Prez, and he went to St. Munchins, if I'm not mistaken, with Ger Burke, and they were playing a Barry Cup final up in Christians there recently, and Kieran was telling me it was 20 years the last time they had won it as well. And there's all this, he was going through the history of it and, what might happen today if history repeats itself. So it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, I actually bumped into Earls a couple of weeks ago in Thomond RFC. He's coaching the back line there. I was down there, went down with Malahide. It's my first time in Thomond, but what a welcome. What a lovely club. What great people. And place packed for an AL game on a Saturday. It was a joy to be there.
Yeah, that's some place to play a match. Yeah. Fitzgerald Park down in Thomond. Anyway, not sure how Talla yesterday compared to Saint-Denis, but I want to start... Well, start in full, I suppose, with where you were on Saturday night, Stade de France, to watch the most gripping game of probably the most gripping Six Nations we've ever seen.
Yeah, I was just saying, my last four games in Stade de France have been the World Cup final, the two semi-finals. France lost to South Africa by a point, Ireland lost to New Zealand by a point, and then obviously Saturday night, like what? Three of the best games I've ever been to in my life. And Saturday was absolutely bonkers in terms of, like, I think we hoped England could show up, but they showed up on a level that we haven't seen this championship. Even the Wales game, it was a different nature of a performance than in round one, but fairness, it's like they threw off the shackles and wanted to play, and they have good players, and that's why I think everyone's been so frustrated or surprised by how poor they've been. But when you have Finn Smith and Freeman and Elliot Daly playing second playmaker, and the pace they have on the edges with Murley and Roebuck, they're a dangerous side. And I thought Chesham at six was outstanding. I know he's getting a lot of slack for not going under the post, but their pack looks just so much better balanced. You know, and it's crazy to think that Borthwick, who's a line-out geek, has gone for three open sides consistently. But just with Alex Coles, who can play six as well, Adolje was back to his best, and England went after France. And France could never significantly pull away from them. They were just about to pull away from them, because I think they scored 21 points in a row when Chesham got that intercept, and that would have been the game over, because England were all over the place, and there was a massive space to go through. But he made a big play, and then suddenly France doubted themselves. And obviously, with a couple minutes to go, they kicked off with only 14 players, and you say, right, you know, it's going to take a miracle for him to win. And they actually engineered a line break. It was a great tackle from Pollock on Dupont. A couple of phases later, Pollock gets a turnover, and all he's got to do is just keep the ball. He tries on a ridiculous offload. Was it Murley tried to fly hack it? And again, France milked a penalty. But England was so disappointed, because France were kind of out on their feet, and they were far enough out that they weren't going to do any damage. And I think there's two penalties. One was from Holly Davidson called in a high tackle on Josh Brennan, who fair play to him, with come on and play a role. And then there was an Itoje deliberate knock on. So there was two offences. But then Ramos, like, Itoje, I don't know if you could see it on camera, Itoje was really acting the goat, trying to put him off. There was big confusion about where the penalty was. I thought the referee kind of lost calmness for it. It was very hard. But eventually, when he put the ball down, you know, it was kind of like that Gavin Henson moment when he said, go celebrate, and he just kicked it. And Ramos is up there with Andre Pollard. I'd say the two of them are the two players you'd want to kick a penalty to win the game or draw.
Johnny, put us into a kicker's pair of boots there, and just frame of mind for, like, trying to actually just kind of level your head for a kick of that magnitude. And as Bernard said, there was all sorts going on around, and the English players were trying to get into his head. There was confusion around where the spot of the penalty was going to be. He probably had, there must have been 2 minutes between when the penalty was awarded and when he actually got to stand down over it. And there's a great shot doing the rounds on social media of directly behind Ramos when he hit that. And I mean, as soon as the ball leaves his foot, not only do we all know it's gone over, but as soon as it leaves his foot, he is turned around, fist pump, he knows he's got it. Like, there wasn't a moment where his mind seemed to wander, just completely ice cool.
Yeah, was it William Servat just gave it the big one as soon as he kicked it? He wasn't even after kicking it yet. He might as well have told everyone to go celebrate. But now, in the kicker's mind, like, it depends on who you are and your age and experience. But, like, you know, as a young kicker, I definitely would have been thinking, don't win a penalty, like, don't win a penalty, I'm going to have to kick this. And then you kind of grow up and learn that, you know, you want to kick a penalty because you want the opportunity for people to see you and to do something for your team. So I think it's a for me anyway, it was a complete change of mindset across time, like that you have to step into these things and what are you on the pitch for otherwise. Like, you know, I know you hear goal kickers saying like, oh, I really wanted the opportunity, but there's times where you don't mind being 4 points down because you have to score a 5-pointer, you have to score a try to win it, and the kicker is happy with that, like, you know. But as I said, over time you kind of you step into it and you want it to happen. And Ramos, I was looking at him arguing and I was like, Jesus, will you stop? Like, it's as French as it gets, arguing over where the penalty is instead of getting his mind right. And I was thinking, is he going to put himself off? But then, as Bernard says, like, is he the top goal kicker at the moment in the world? I'd say his stats wouldn't be far off it.
Yeah.
And you were just kind of thinking, is he that confident that he can go around arguing with people, pushing fellas away from himself, and then he puts the ball in the tee and sticks it over? But, you know, I was only thinking about it earlier in the game. I was, as I do now in my mid-30s, I watch the match through WhatsApp with my buddies. Like, you know, we don't get together at the moment. And I was going to text in and be like, of all the teams, like, France had the goal kicker, and I never sent it. And I was like, what a massive regret. I could have put it on a timeline, you know. But I thought if it came down to it, obviously Ramos was going to be the one that would stick something over. But if you look at the, I actually met Dave McHugh at the 20s game on Sunday, and I was like, was it high tackle? How did you get on with the refereeing and all that? And he's coaching Georgian referee Hamish Kelly, and he showed me a reverse angle, and it was a head-on-head. That was the first one that was going around on Twitter, wasn't it? That wasn't a high tackle, apparently. Now, I know they took the other penalty with a toe just slapping the ball down, but what madness from England. Like, you know, I know Henry Pollock had the turnover and he wants to probably get away from his own half and all the rest of it, but, you know, two penalties in the last sequence, and as Bernard said, they're actually going backwards and they looked like they were inside out tired, like, you know.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest thing after all their efforts. You can talk about going under the post with Ali Chesson, but like, that's very easy for us on TV, on Twitter, on whatever it is. He's after intercepting a ball and he's probably gassed and he's just seeing a try line. Like, I'd be going that way as well. But maybe the celebration is the one that has annoyed people. But yeah, for Thomas Ramos to step up like that, as calm as he was, for everyone around him to know that this has gone straight between the sticks, I think that shows what kind of a quality operator he is and how confident they are over his goal kicking.
Yeah, and he obviously he carried the weight of disappointment, or because of that World Cup exit, because he was blocked down from the conversion, if you remember.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I don't know, it probably wasn't covered a lot here, but in France he got a lot of stick for that, which sounds crazy, you know, because he's an unbelievable goal kicker. But apparently he was very hard on himself, and it took him a while to get over that. So there's a little bit of redemption for him there. It's obviously not a World Cup, but I was reading yesterday the amount of medals he's won now over, like, he thinks he's 31, like, between top 14s, Champions
yeah.
Cups, Six Nations Championships, Grand Slams. He's a phenomenal addition to France, and he's not just a brilliant goal kicker. Like, we saw him in this championship really comfortable stepping up into that 10 role, and obviously you were using Jalibert a little bit. It's probably the best 10-15 combination in terms of natural first receivers, I think, that any of the teams have. And he's a superstar.
Take
the best
away
part
the.
of it is, sorry Neil, the best part of it is, like, you know, you're watching him being this absolute maverick and the chaos going on, and he's so calm, like slapping the ball away to someone behind his goal line, or like volleying the ball across the pitch or something. Like, that's for people watching him, like, he might look like he's wild on the pitch. He seems to know what he's doing, Bernard, doesn't he? Like, even all those things are probably some bit calculated. He knows there's someone behind him, he'll slap the ball back there. Like, but what a player to watch.
Yeah, like, even I was gonna say, even take away the goal kicking and he's in contention still for player of the championship. I think even in the Scotland game 10 days ago, he was one of the few French players that seemed to be on it for the duration, and, you know, from an attacking point of view, was doing everything to actually pull them back into it.
He's incredibly consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah, he very rarely has an off day either in general play or with the boot. But yeah, I mean, France's last two games, like, to finish a championship like that, having looked unbeatable for first three, and then obviously lose quite heavily in Scotland, but still score 40 points, and then do everything but lose that game. Like, they've won the silverware and it's great, but they're still, I don't know, I'd say they're not nearly as confident as they were kind of going into that final week.
Yeah. You know, can you ever remember a team that won a championship conceding 96 points in their final two games? For England, before we move it on to Ireland, does that performance keep Steve Borthwick's job? And if it does, are we going to see them play a little bit more with the shackles off? Or was that the adrenaline of the occasion, the backs against the wall, meant that they just kind of let loose a little bit and will probably go back to the norm in the summer when they're playing against South Africa.
Look, all the soundings from the squad off the record are that the only coach they really, really like is Lee Blackett, who's the attack coach, and a lot of the criticism of...
And a good attack coach, yeah, based on what we saw the other night.
100%, but a lot of the issues was that he obviously went in there and they didn't look like a Lee Blackett coach side, and Lee Blackett has lots of... We have lots of evidence of what a Lee Blackett coach side looks like through Wasps, Scarlets and Bath in terms of the attack. So on Saturday night, they looked like a Lee Blackett coach side. So what happened in Girona, you know, which is where they were in a camp before they went to Paris after that loss in Italy. It definitely seems there's a shift in how they wanted to play. Defensively, they're still very porous. I mean, you know, they conceded a lot of points in this championship. There's a lot of tries that could have easily been stopped, Ireland included, the Irish game between them included. So they have three defence coaches. In actual fact, they kind of have four, if you include Kevin Sinfield, who initially was defence coach, and now he's in there as kind of a cultural architect. My understanding is that there'll be changes there. And I think what Portugal will do is he'll chop some of his staff to save himself, and then they'll go through the first block of these Nations Cup games in July, and then even though it's getting late to make a call... after that, I think if the results don't improve, like they still lost, they still lost four out of five games, and for that England squad, that's not acceptable. So it's just a case of whether the changes he makes underneath him keep the players happy, and they can have a good opening to the. But I think they go to South Africa first, so like it's not easy.
Ellis Park, you know, Johannesburg.
They could be five in a row, five losses in a row, without not being better. So. I don't know, he doesn't inspire confidence. A lot of the ex-players are after him. I'm sure the RFU and the fans, the RFU will be conscious of the fan sentiment because that's what got Eddie Jones out in the end. But certainly, if England play good rugby, I think if they continue to play good rugby, he'll be okay because they're so good that they'll win a lot of games. But if they go back to that heavy kick game, I think people will turn on him.
Speaking on that, actually, and again, just before we get to the Ireland match, I'll give you an opportunity to take a little bit of a victory lap here because I haven't heard too many people in the last 4 or 5 weeks talking about how the game of rugby is headed into a dark place with all this kicking. The game as a spectacle is being ruined by all the box kicks and all the aerial contests, and we're heading to a dreadful place for the game of rugby union.
Yeah.
It's all dried up a little bit in the last few weeks, isn't it?
Look, the game is in an unbelievable place. Imagine, like, Eddie Jones slagged off the World Rugby for basically rubber stamping the laws as they are at the State of the Game conference, saying it was just 200 people on a jolly. But I think if you were part of that, and I was part of it in a small way...
Was it a jolly?
No, I wasn't. Part of the decision that the game is actually in a good place. I think Felix Jones is our massive credit because he's the one who I suppose created the push and helped World Rugby get rid of the escort. And I think, like, I know it's been highly controversial, but I think there's been a wider effect. Like, because, think of Reece Carey try, okay, just use that as an example, or some of France's defence or some of England's defence in that game, or even Ireland's defence, which is brilliant against Scotland, but still conceded.
Three tries.
Yeah. And had to make 200 and whatever, over 230 tackles or something like that. So the game we have at the moment, there's way less breaks, right? So the Reece Carey try, like Furlong and Jack Conan, it's 39th minute. They've had a huge amount of effort in the previous minutes. And just for that moment, they're just dying to get to halftime to get a break. And they get exploited on a blind side where Tighe is left isolated with Ballacombe. But it's the players not being able to get around a corner to help him there quickly. And that's kind of what's happening here. I mean, like, has Sean Edwards' defensive system changed? No, it hasn't. And he's been there a long time. Do the players know how to defend? Yes, they do. But I actually think physically they're not able to implement it like they were in the past. And these really high-scoring games are going to become more of the norm. Thankfully, the players have the skill set now to be comfortable keeping the ball in play and threatening these defences who aren't set. Like, you look at their breakdown over the last 3 or 4 rounds. Okay, there's obviously some great jackal turnovers at the right time from an Irish point of view. Tighe Byrne, etc., is still able to do what he does. But the effectiveness of the counter ruck and the barge has dropped off dramatically. So the likes of Gibson Park, the likes of Ben Spencer, the likes of Antoine Dupont, Ben White are getting unbelievably quick ball. And like, it's defenses are under heels for most of the game now. And I think it's way better to watch. It's not just the escort, but the escort has meant that the pressure on players to get into that kick chase line or to get into that cradle is so much greater that they're just being pushed another little bit further. And referees are being pushed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the high ball and play time isn't just affecting the players. I think the last 10 minutes of that game, Yamakashvili was under serious fatigue as well, you know, and that's creating a challenge in itself. But it makes a great spectacle. And there's going to be mistakes as well. Like, I actually think the strip from Pollock probably was a penalty to France in the first place. But certainly what happened after that with Pollock passing, even though he's only off the bench, and Murdy kicking it, is down to some fatigue as well.
Yeah, and I think you could even see, looking back at the Ireland match, the last 10 minutes of the first half wasn't particularly good. When you actually look back at it, and again, you're probably talking fatigue because it was a high ball and play time across that. It had been a brilliant first 30 minutes and both teams looked a little scrappy for those 10 minutes before a really good second half. Johnny, just to come to you on that kick chase stuff, do you think if they had just sold it to us from day one that we could see more of these Reece Carey tries with a prop run in from 20 metres, people would have been on board with this from day one?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure what they were selling it as, to be honest. I thought it was safety and an aerial battle and everything else. But I think, you know, whether it's the kicking game is just something that exists, but like the transition, like the game has gone to a lot of transition, isn't it? So it's trying to, even the kick game itself, you're trying to get a one-on-one in the air to break a ball so someone else can get an unstructured attack. You know, that's what it's all about, you know. So that's what we're really after getting to. If you think about some of the teams, like France in particular, they don't... Like, France have a very solid set piece, yet they'll throw quick lineouts just to get the game up in tempo, you know. So it's all about transition at the moment, and that's where the game is benefiting massively. But, excuse me, if you look at, like, Scotland, Italy, France in particular, I think they made a massive effort to go more unstructured. And then Ireland from round one to round five, I thought they made a different effort as well to kind of live in that unstructured chaos, like, you know, put a bit of their own stamp on what that means. And maybe not as much as the others, because I don't think they have to. I think they're very good off set piece. If you look at the opening quarter of the game, like, they went to three really accurate set piece plays and they scored three out of three, like, they made 19 points from three entries. But I actually thought, on the refereeing point that Bernard makes, I thought Luke Pearce was doing the kind of very modern let the attack play, and unless you're Tadhg Byrne wrapping up the ball, you know, and taking it away from everyone else, he wasn't really giving the turnover, which is when, you know, you look at Scotland going 19 phases to score, Ireland couldn't get the ball, and they're a massive breakdown team and defensive breakdown team, and they couldn't stop Scotland. So it's kind of credit to Scotland's attack and breakdown, where they put Ireland in their attacking sequences, but also maybe how Luke Pearce was allowing them to just retain the ball, because that's what we would have felt in the AIL. When you get some of the pro refs or budding pro refs, the attacking team definitely get the rub of the green, because that's the way they're refing the game. It's so, so hard to get the ball back. So if you go to a kicking game and don't win the ball in the air, don't win the scraps, you can say goodbye to the ball for a while, like, you know. So I think that's what I saw. Definitely the opening quarter I thought was an absolute attacking clinic from both sides, but I definitely think there was you know, referee influence on keeping the ball with the attacking team.
Yeah, Johnny, I think if you've the little clampdown that happened post-Christmas on players swinging around.
Mm.
So the counter rucker swinging his legs around. Like, have you seen that in any Six Nations game?
I've seen Doris tried it.
Yes.
And I don't think he was penalised, but he was basically told.
He's taking it out of his game. Yeah. He might have tried it once, but none of the other teams are trying it now because they realise it's going to be penalised. And that has cleaned up the breakdown so much. Do you think back to the Interpros over Christmas? Every rook had someone swinging around. The ball was incredibly slow. Also, I think the ball carrier, I've noticed this, has been allowed to be a little bit more... Sorry, the tackle player with the ball has been allowed to be a little bit more active on the ground than they were. Okay, so back in the Joe Schmidt days and, man on fire, basically. So to be moving so much on the ground that the jackler can't get you. People were afraid of that because referees were quite focused on that. That's now... Like you saw against England, Ireland, you know, landing on the right shoulder, moving to left shoulder, and then recoiling, which just gives you a second more. And then I think the referees, you can come into the ruck any angle you want. You can come off your feet. You can take people out. As long as you don't have head contact, they're not interested. Which is creating this rapid ball. And you could say, yeah, but you're not really burning defenders in the ruck. If the ball is that quick, the defenders that will be in the ruck aren't really able to get into the defensive line properly and get set, or they're very narrow anyway, so it doesn't matter. So it's the game has evolved. And what I'm fascinated to see is what happens now. So this is the Six Nations. This is the Northern Hemisphere competition. Pretty easy to get referees all on the same page. So what happens now when you bring the South Africa, New Zealand, Australia in this Nations Cup? And can this type of rugby be played at a World Cup when historically pressure... Now we've had great games at World Cups, but yeah. Historically pressure and nerves and tension makes it easier or harder to play that way. It's great to see it, but what will happen now in the European Cup, what will happen in the Nations Cup, and what will happen in the World Cup? We'll be able to keep this type of rugby going.
Yeah, it's going to set up very, very nicely. On the Ireland game specifically, so Ireland, in fairness, saved their best game for last, 43-21 against Scotland. A strange scoreline because I don't think it flattered Ireland, because Ireland were really excellent on the day across almost all aspects of the game. But it also doesn't really reflect Scotland's contribution in the match. You look at it and say 22-point win, that was a thrashing for Ireland. In reality, that was a serious contest for 65, 70 minutes. And it just took Ireland hitting just their top gear, get the subs on the bench, see things out, and turn it into a 22-point on the face of it hammering. But as good a 22-point game of rugby as you're ever going
to
see.
Yeah, I think, and it's a game Ireland had to win rather than Scotland lost.
Yeah.
You know, if you think back to the Murrayfield game where Keane Healy's thrown in and things like that, after the game they would have been having serious question marks around their own inability to perform. I thought they performed very well, and they were pretty, like, obviously they had their setbacks as well, losing two locks in the week of the game, losing their hooker early. And but Ireland were on it. You know, I totally agree with you. It was Ireland's best performance of the championship. And when they play like that, they're an opposition that most teams will struggle with, you know. And unfortunately for Scotland, you know, Andy Farrell said during the week, the fact that we'd won 11 in a row was irrelevant. I don't think it is with Scotland.
It's irrelevant to Ireland. It's not irrelevant to Scotland.
It's irrelevant to Ireland. And even I think in Ireland, they believe if they pitch that they'll win. But for them, like, it's an incredible run of losses against a team that on paper, there's not that gulf, you know. And there's a lot of games now that are, like, there's so little between these top teams that it's going to be a bounce of ball, a refereeing decision. But Scotland have struggled over the last 12 times to make it a refereeing decision or bounce the ball, because they just haven't been able to bring it. Now, in fairness, I think Saturday was one of their best performances against Ireland. But yeah, they ran into an Irish team who just, I'd say they'd love another game. I think they're just starting to really find their mojo and click.
Johnny, on that, the fact that Scotland played well, that was certainly the sense we got from Andy Farrell. One of the things he was most pleased about of the victory itself was the fact that they actually came up against a Scotland that asked a lot of questions of them. Because as Bernard said, there have been, if you look back at a handful of those other 11 victories over the last few years, there have been games where Ireland have come out of the blocks and won inside the first 15, 20 minutes, where Scotland haven't got off the bus, where Scotland have capitulated maybe midway through a game. But this was one where every time Ireland landed a blow, Scotland came back and hit one back at them. And eventually Ireland just started to land a couple more blows down the final stretch.
Yeah, I think there was a few moments there where, you know, Ireland went 7-0 after 3 minutes and you're thinking, oh, what's going on here? And then Scotland just went back and went 7-0. And that was the best thing for the game. You know, obviously they went score for score. And then the second time I'd be thinking about it was 26-21 on 60 minutes, isn't it? So, like, it was a very tight game for 60 minutes. And even against weaker opposition at this level, you'd be saying it's going to take you time before you're going to break them down. Like, it's international rugby. You're not just going to blow them away in most cases, you know. But I felt that Ireland, in an attacking sense, were so on it analytically, execution-wise. I thought they were really, really good. That's why I was calling it a clinic. I think, you know, I've gone through their first score where James Gibson Park is on a little peel around the back of a line-out and there's actually a gap in front of him, and you're not used to him not seeing that gap. But it's a two-phase setup. Like, I think, Bernard, you were talking about this on Against the Head actually as well, weren't you? But it's clearly a two-phase thing that they've seen and they've gotten them under the sticks. But the most impressive part within that kind of attacking, you know, tit for tat, is that when Finn Russell had the ball in the Irish 22, putting them under pressure to be the ones to get the second score in a row, Ireland managed him really well, I think. You could see, like, we're used to line speed in defence at the moment, where, you know, the Jack Nienaber one, everyone's going for line speed. But I think the game is shifting slightly. Maybe it's because of the attack, Bernard, I'm not sure. But defences aren't set enough to get off the line and hammer all the time. So you see Gary Ringrose with buying time a lot. They were kind of, I think, what they call like a shield. So like their backs are just kind of shepherding a small bit. When they get comfortable on the edge, the call comes in to get forward. And that's the one that was it Stuart McCluskey or Gary Ringrose got Finn Russell inside in the 22.
McCluskey and Ringrose
Was it
picked up the
McCluskey?
scraps.
And then Jack Crowley had a bit of a spiral bounce into touch. They turned over that maul and they got the ball back to go to get their kind of two scores away from them and all that kind of stuff. So I think what they did to Finn Russell, like he had a decent game, but he had no impact on the overall winning of the game. I would have said, I know he scored a try, but it was like they were shepherding him, shielding him, and next thing they went in and they got him, and they didn't make decisions for him. They waited till they were set themselves, and then they put him under pressure, and the ball started spilling a small bit. So I think that's another really impressive part of what they did. I just think when you put together a performance that you analyze, you say what your plan is going to be, and then you execute the plan, it looked like everything came together from their perspective, coaches down to players, you know.
Yeah, I think, Johnny, you're 100% right. I think it's in Ireland, use Ireland as an example. So against France, you saw Ireland trying to jam in and make reads. And obviously that would have been a pretty difficult defensive review for Ireland. And there's all this talk about mixed messages and different defensive systems, etc. I thought since that French game, Ireland defended, whether you're an Ulster player, a Leinster player, a Connacht player in it, you defended like Ireland and everybody's on the same page. And this staying connected piece was far more relevant. And I think Ireland became hard to beat then. Obviously, you can sometimes give up yards and it's hard to get the ball back, but you're not getting line breaks against you as regularly as you would have been a little bit earlier on. And I actually think the pressure now is coming, instead of the pressure coming from outside, so if the ball is coming from left to right, historically with that blitz, your Finn Russell, for example, is worried about what's happening on his outside. It's actually now inside pressure. So where the ball is coming from, that's where you can actually really go hard and try and get that hit that creates a turnover. So it's just shifted a little bit there. But I thought Ireland's defensive work rate and communication to sniff out a very good Scotland attack, a very dangerous Scotland attack, who would obviously put 50 on France and put up a good score against England. We were very much on it, and Simon Easterby deserves massive credit for that.
And even to follow on from that as well, another very promising development on the defensive side of things is, if you look back at maybe in November, and Andy Farrell, I remember speaking after the South Africa game, one of the silver linings he was really clinging to was just how difficult they were making it for South Africa to actually score a try. Just that last ditch defence, pin back into your 22, making them work one more phase. But I suppose the issue back then, and probably in the France game as well, was, and probably for a year or so leading up to it, was when teams were getting into the Irish 22, they were probably getting a penalty inside two, three phases. And quite often they were getting another penalty inside two, three phases. And even if it was taking them a long time to score, they were eventually getting the try, and Ireland were giving teams extra opportunities to score. We've seen that dry up so much across the Six Nations, but they haven't lost the scramble. They haven't lost the last ditch effort. So teams are coming into the Irish 22. They're actually coming in quite often. I remember looking back before the game at the weekend, the stats would have said, I think Ireland were giving up the second most amount of 22 entries per match, but they were conceding the fewest amount of points per 22 entry. So, you know, the stats would show there that the last ditch defence is still there, but crucially, they're not giving teams a second and third opportunity to go again.
Yeah, I agree. And also, it wasn't just in the 22. We were giving away a lot of stupid penalties further out the field through offsides.
To allow you into the 22.
Yeah, through breakdown infringements on the defensive side of the ball. So that was a big concern. And again, I know Farrell was really worried about that. Going into November, it didn't really get fixed properly in November. The South Africa match was such an outlier because of so many scrum penalties and obviously entry points, entries into 22 off the back of scrums in particular. South Africa was so dominant physically. But I thought, again, during the Six Nations, that's improved massively. Because Ireland were always a team who had good discipline and that has started to drift a bit. Referees were very conscious of some of the things we were doing, and it needed to be nipped in the bud. And I think now coming out of this championship, we've given a fairly clear picture, bar the scrum, which obviously improved against Scotland, that we're an easy team to referee in terms of we're fairly legal.
Yeah, fairly legal. At the moment.
We're pushing the boundaries, but not going over the top.
Fairly legal is the best way to be in rugby, really.
Of course, you need
to be close to a legal.
Honestly, if you're not pushing the boundaries, you're way off.
Yeah. If you're very legal, you're losing a lot of games. This is more of a vibes-based discussion rather than stats, but feels like Andy Farrell has his spark back as well. Yeah. I just from kind of being around press conferences and stuff, during the second half of last year, after the Lions in November, he seemed tense. He seemed just kind of edgy and kind of tense, I think is the right word. And I almost think that big defeat to France in Paris was... He's like someone now who's come off the back of a health scare where he's got this new lease of life, and he seems to have that energy about him all over again the last few weeks, and he's just kind of walking around chest out, speaking chest out. And I think maybe having a bit of a lash off the team after Paris has just kind of reinvigorated everyone a little bit. Yeah. Now, I could be looking with rose-tinted glasses. But
look, he's a winner. Right? Yeah. So the vast, vast majority of his career, he's been winning. He brought the British and Irish Lions down to Australia. They won, but I think they didn't win in the manner that he would have liked. He came back for November, and it was patchy. Let's be honest, it was patchy, and there was frustrations and worries. And then he's watching the provinces, and it's a little bit mixed. And then they're coming into camp, and then he gets that poor performance against France. And that's not the world he wants to be in. He wants to be building something that's spectacular, that's exciting. So absolutely, I think he saw improvement against Italy. He saw obviously that huge emotional outburst you saw from England because he knew how important that game was. And I think now he's looking back at he'll be reviewing the Six Nations this week with his coaching staff, and they'll see so many positives. They'll see Ireland finding a way they want to play again. They'll see Ireland's work rate and intent gone up massively. They'll see new faces. They'll see more squad depth. They'll see the likes of, Doris and James Ryan and Dan Sheen and Tyke Furlong back to their best. And, that's down to him. Like, he managed that, whether it took a bollocking after France. But it also took giving the players the right tactical and technical messages to go and be very close to a championship and go four in a row. So I've no doubt he'll sign his contract. I absolutely agree with you. I think he's now invigorated by this challenge again because he sees players who respond to him. And he's never had players who haven't, but... everybody is a bit paranoid, and you wonder, he'd be the same as everyone else going, geez, has my message gone tired here? But now he's seen that he's been able to bring this team back to their best, which is phenomenally hard to do, and he's done it.
You've no doubt he'll hang around?
Yeah, he'll stay, yeah.
Johnny, what are you thinking?
I don't know anything about his contract negotiations, burn it up.
But I'll put more onto the demand management stuff where you would have seen even small things, Johnny, I suppose, like... Players have been dropped either out of a 23 or just to a bench. Think of James Lowe, Tyke Byrne, Jamieson Gibson-Park, Dan Shee and Josh van der Fleer. Almost every one of the frontline players who's either been left out of a 23 or dropped down to a bench came back the following week and put in their best performance at the championship.
I think his own performance across the Six Nations has been incredible. I know... Like, it's funny when a guy is not double jobbing and just looking after one international team. Like, it must be so easy for him at this stage. He's so good, but when he's doing the Lions and trying to keep control over everything that's happening in Ireland, because that's what the word was. He was doing everything really from a distance. But obviously that's a massive amount of work. And then he got his hands on his own team. November happened, but the Six Nations, they get so much time together. They were in Portugal for a week. You can only imagine that's the key part of it. They were all together again. And maybe the first result against France was the best thing that he could do, was just go in and rattle some cages and go and get control over the whole thing again. Like maybe Andy Farrell stepped back up, I think he's got serious credit with the players. I think, every time they get picked, they feel like they're being dropped. When you get dropped, every time you go out for them, you want to I'm told you want to impress them no matter whether you're starting X amount of games in a row or whether you're in for the first time. Like that's it's obviously a sign of a good man manager, but he's incredible at what he does. I even heard the line again after Scotland, we did it through adversity. That it's been a while since we heard about the adversity. They were living in it for a while and now he's relishing it again, you know. So I know the frustration for people will be, you know, some of the decisions that he went away for a while and then, you know, back to the old ground of Sam versus Jack, and maybe Jack was the guy that he should have backed, but now he's after getting a whole different version of Jack Crowley again because he's after fighting through more challenges, and I think he's done really well in the last couple of weeks. So I think he's come out of the Six Nations kind of knowing where he is. His older players have definitely come out of like a comfort zone, I would say, and they have to go on and prove themselves to him again. He's got the best out of all his older players, you know, like McCluskey is in the form of his life. I know he probably hasn't had the same kind of run at it from an international perspective, but Gibson Park, you know, Tadhg Byrne, have you ever seen them playing so well or be so influential? We probably have a couple of years ago, but they're back to it, and I think that's what he's done. But I think he's a really impressive guy. No matter how many times you look at old videos of him and new interviews with him, he's massively impressive. And the longer Ireland keep on to him, I think the better for everyone.
Yeah, just I have no inside track on his contract, but I think he looks like he's happy again, right? Which is very important. And then secondly, like the RFU are famously buying houses in the back of Havelock Square, investing in bricks and mortar. The best investment they could ever get is tying him down. You know, like honestly, if Ireland are going to go through a rebuild post World Cup, which you have to say logically they are, because Furlong and Bundee Aki and these fellas, they can't go on forever. They're not going to defy medical science. But he is the one. He's the one I would like to have guiding that next generation through. You know, who understands the Irish system inside out, who has a rapport and respect from players, who's brought in Johnny Sexton, Paul O'Connell, John Fogarty, you know, Irish players, and now helping them transition to coaching. Doesn't cause mayhem in the media, doesn't fight with the union, doesn't cause massive trouble with the provinces. Like, let's be honest, like some of the head coaches around the world aren't as easy managers he seems to be, and you know, brings around our 20s in every year. And gives them a shot and speaks to them and you know, I think it'd be the best investment here if you could make. It'll be expensive, but you're basically making a solid investment because you know this man and you know what he can do.
And to follow on what you just said there, like if someone wants to make the argument, well, Andy Farrell might want a new challenge. Well, you listed out a handful of the players that are probably going to be moving on after this World Cup. If he wants a new challenge, you can stay in the Ireland job because that is going to be an entirely new challenge post 2027. Like effectively rebuilding the brilliant team you've had from scratch all over again. And you mentioned the rest of his coaching team as well. He made a point after the match of saying that, you know, this coaching team are still learning. And I know a few of them have been in place a long time, but Johnny Sexton is only there. He's only there 6 months as a full-time employee. Andrew Goodman's still only 2 years in the job. And you look back at the Scotland game and the championship as a whole, and I think every single one of them can kind of take something from it. Like I look at it, scrum obviously was the big issue through the championship, but held up very, very well at the weekend, albeit Scotland aren't the best scrummaging team in the world. But you've brought through Tom O'Toole, who I think already has punched his ticket for the World Cup. Just with what he's been able to show across both sides of the scrum. Line out has been much better, and Paul O'Connell will be absolutely delighted that they got a mall try at the weekend as well. Andrew Goodman got that beautiful first phase strike for Rab Balakoon, and I'm sure himself and Paul O'Connell both had hands over the opening try of the game with that two phase move. Johnny Sexton got a tune out of Jack Crowley, particularly in that final game. The kicking settled down, both out of hand and with the ball and off the ground. And as we mentioned, Simon Easterby's defence was brilliant for the final four rounds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they are still gelling together. And I think that's part of the reason maybe Johnny went on the Lions tour was to get more experience. Obviously, Goodman went on the Lions tour. But you can really see that connection. Everything is connected. So Johnny's responsible for exits, you know, and our exits are good. Obviously, he's doing a bit of mentoring with the tens, and I thought Jack was superb. You know, the pressure he was under last week, and to come out and have a big game up against someone like Finn Russell, it's just flipped massively from the negativity that was there post France. But that I stand over the fact that post France, any criticism we had wasn't based on just that 80 minutes. It was based on
it was based on November.
It was based on a summer tour, which obviously wasn't valid because it was to Portugal and Georgia, and the main lads were in the British and Irish Lions, and last year Six Nations. So, but what we've seen since has been an excellent way of responding to that, and actually kind of finding, I'm sure it's way more enjoyable for them as well. Players aren't stupid. Players know when you're just a little bit off and when you're just struggling for a little bit of confidence or a little bit of form, and they've now got that back, which is great.
And it's pure speculation as well, I wonder, Johnny, but with the championship being 1 week less this year than it previously had been, does that just kind of sharpen everything? Does it force you to maybe rest things up a little bit, as you saw with some of the front line players, sorry, dropping in and out? We'll probably find out a bit more about that as the years go on and we see how the rest of the Six Nations develops over the years. But really, really important as well, Ireland got a triple crown, finished second in the Six Nations, finished within a kick of a ball of winning the championship, but did it while also widening the net. You know, they got a good short-term result from, all, you know, also thinking long-term. They did it without Andrew Porter, Paddy McCarthy, Jack Boyle, Ryan Baird, Robbie Henshaw, Hugo Keane and Mac Hansen. And even with all of those players out, used more players than Andy Farrell has ever used in a Six Nations, 35 players. 11 of those had their first experience of Six Nations rugby over the campaign. And I know they're not necessarily all young players, but inexperienced at this level as well.
Yeah, and I think we didn't know what the team selection was going to be week to week, did we? Like, you could have named most of it, but you didn't know.
Yeah.
Did you know Darren Murray was going to come on and score the try that everyone thought was Caelan Doris? You know, to have the influence on the game, I suppose. And it felt like it wasn't as big as the Mac Hansen moment, but Darren Murray, like, was anyone crying out for him to start or play in the final game? And then he's having a massively influential moment. So they're the things that they see inside in camp and being together for so long. And as you say, you know, did Andy Farrell and his coaching team have a conversation around how they manage the Six Nations differently to other teams? Because, like, Ty Byrne didn't start the game, Josh van der Fleer was in and out. And whether he was telling them in the background, I need to manage our minutes, I doubt he was. I'd say in his own head he might have been managing them, but to them they were dropped. And he was getting reactions out of fellas every week. Like, and you know, is it 35 players? Did you say that, or I heard it somewhere?
35, yeah.
35 players.
His previous highest would have been 32 or 3, I believe.
And it just sounded like from his interview that he was very, very happy with how the Six Nations went. And, you know, we keep getting obsessed with that, like, oh, we didn't win the championship this time. But when we get knocked out of a World Cup quarterfinal, people are talking about sacrificing Six Nations to build a bigger, you know, system or more players or the longer term picture. So maybe we can just live in this at the moment and trust that there's a longer term picture. And if we get beyond the quarterfinal of a World Cup, I know the structure is going to change. But if we get more success in a World Cup, you look back at moments like this and go, well, they were very, very successful championships, not winning it, but getting all the other metrics right, I think.
It does lead you to the really, really interesting question of, if everyone is fit, what does the Ireland team look like? And particularly the back line, back three. Mm. What does that look like in Sydney in June? I think that's the first, or in July, that's the first game of the Nations Championship. Australia and Sydney.
I thought Osborne made a serious improvement game to game. I thought he looked so much more comfortable in game four, game five. But has he ousted Keenan? Probably no, he hasn't. I think Keenan is still incredibly important. Obviously, he's got to get back to his best, but I think Osborne will end up, you know, being a long-term centre for Ireland. When Bundy and Robbie and McCluskey and Gary go, he'll probably end up playing in there. But what an option he is now at fullback. I think James Lowe is still very important to Ireland. And whether it's kicking game, whether it's that offload power game that he brings. So I don't know if Tommy has been excellent. I think that's close. I'd still say Lowe potentially still ahead. And it's the other side. I think, and this is harsh on Mac, and Mac will probably end up playing somewhere, but I think Balakoon,
there's just something different.
Every team needs an out-and-out wheels man, like just pace, I think. And I think he has had a very good tournament. And he's not just pace. Like, his power, his work rate off the ball has been excellent. So
aerial ability.
aerial ability is top class, yeah. And again, we know how important it is. And this is really hard. The only reason I'm picking Mac out because Mac plays right wing and he plays right wing.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that Mac couldn't potentially play left wing or play fullback for Hugo. We know he's very good there. But I think Balakoon is the one who now is in the starting team, regardless, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Johnny, what's your back three looking like for Eden Park in July?
Well, the first thing I was going to say was Balakoon, because I think he's nailed on. You know, I think what he offers, like it's the pace, but it's actually his footwork, you know, that very quick stop and acceleration again. It's incredible. And then even if you look at his finish from the McCluskey pass, you're kind of going, yeah, he's 2 foot short. And then the arm came out, you know, he's like just finishing, you know. I think he's an incredible finisher. And I think I've said it before, but like I'd be looking at AIL games going, like previewing Ballinhinch, being like, oh, Rob Balakoon isn't back to Ballinhinch again. Like he'd go away, like, you know, it's get out of our league, you know. And I think it's just been because of injury and everything else. But if he gets a clean run at it, it's obviously hard to call a team when some fellas aren't bad. Like if Matt Hansen came and played a couple of games, you'd be going, oh geez, he's nailed on again, because that's how he plays. But if you're calling a team for like right now at the moment, Balakoon definitely plays. I agree with Bernard that I thought Jamie Osborne was very good, but I think Hugo Keenan has something that is very hard to displace. His work rate and speed across the backfield, his aerial ability. They're different players, but I think Hugo Keenan will go back in. And it's very hard to change that backline now, regardless. Like Gibson Park, Jack Crowley, you can't take Short McCluskey out of it. Ringrose, I don't see anyone really displacing Ringrose. If they challenge him, maybe they'd have a cut off it, but he's actually, I would reckon there's a lot of intangibles around Gary Ringrose in their system that people wouldn't give him credit for anyway, but he still comes up with big moments. I know people want him to have like a better cut off their attack and everything else, but I just think there's something in the middle of what he does that brings, that keeps people together. So it's very hard to change anyone at the moment besides Keenan, I would say.
What happens to Tom O'Toole over the next few months?
I can see Tom O'Toole, and I certainly heard rumours that they're now going to try and get more game time into him, as Lou said. If you think about Ulster's situation, once Angus Bell goes...
I think Richie Murphy's made it fairly clear he sees him as a tight end for the rest of the season, at least.
That's fair enough, but I spoke to Jimmy Duffy at the start of Six Nations. If you remember, I was saying we should have went to him against France, as Lou said, but that was based on speaking to Jimmy Duffy around, does he get reps of training at Lou said? And he said, yeah, they have put him in there and he's very comfortable, etc. So obviously with Angus Bell there, you're going to play him for Ulster because Richie needs to try and do something and maximise Ulster's chance of winning. Mm-hmm. But I think next year, you know, when Angus Bell gone, Tom O'Toole has to be a serious option. Lou said, obviously, he can play both sides. And I think he will rotate. I think he'll play both sides over the next year and go to the World Cup as very comfortable on both sides. There is little chat that maybe Andrew Porter's going to play a little bit more on the tight head side, certainly over the next year and a half as well. And that would make sense then. If you had Tom O'Toole, Paddy McCarthy, Jack Boyle, Jeremy Lockman, Michael Milne as loose heads for the next cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Porter maybe replacing Furlong in that tight head depth chart.
Clarkson.
He'd be in a pretty good spot. So I think Tom O'Toole definitely will get more game time at loose head. Maybe not for Ulster short term because of Angus Bell, but because he gives you that power as well. Like he's very, very, like he only had 20 tackles at the
20
weekend.
Tackles
at the weekend. It was funny actually. Owen Slot did a piece in the Times around Ireland and Farrell's man management, but highlighted Tom O'Toole's kind of development as a loose head, and he just said, "Oh, what did Andy Farrell say to you after the match?" And he just said, "Oh, well done."
Yeah.
And he said that meant so much to me, you know what I mean, or whatever. It's like, you know, people think these man manager gurus need to be unbelievable words, and like a well done from Andy Farrell could be the same as a 40 minute conversation with someone else in terms of the impact it has on players. So keep it simple.
Yeah. Couple of final bits before we finish up.
Just going back to the defence, I think the most worried people coming out of this tournament are the defence coaches, right? And I actually think a lot of the teams are trying to defend like South Africa without understanding other tools. And I mainly mean from set piece defence. So if you think about England against Ireland for the Gibson Park first try, you know, Ireland burst them with a scrum play where McCluskey is the distributor. He passed the ball over the top to Balakoon. He gets away, passes back inside Tommy O'Brien. The Balakoon try off a scrum against Scotland like, it's kamikaze defence from Scotland, right? But what they're trying to do there is trying to say, oh, Stuart McCluskey doesn't have the skill set to throw the ball, okay? And then our scramble will get him. Well, yeah, your scramble won't get Robert Balakoon because he's an unbelievable finisher. The Bia Barry try against England from the scrum.
Which one?
Well, no, the one that Jalibert kicked. Again, you see England, like, it's up and in. Oh, yeah, we'll stop the ball. They won't have the skill set to throw it. Yeah, he can't kick it off his right foot. He potentially can't throw it, but he can ease to his left foot and put the grubber kick in through. So I think you're going to see a lot. You know, the players have the skill set now to do things that they couldn't do 2 or 3 years ago. So it'll be interesting how they back off or double down. I'm fascinated to see how set-piece defence changes over the next year.
It's mad though, Bernard, wasn't it? When you look at some of the defensive setups that they've had, you know, you say that players have had the skill set now, or they've just unlocked their brains into how to beat this kind of high line speed because they've been training and playing into it now. But Scotland, like, Blair Kinghorn was defending like a tight winger when McCluskey put the ball over his head. And then if you look at personnel, like, Darcy Graham is the one coming across. If his fullback has gone so early, I think he's a little bit late. But also it's Rob Balakoon and Darcy Graham. And obviously a one-on-one like that, you back Robert Balakoon quite a bit, which is why he's being picked. But then you look at Roebuck, wasn't it? When Jalibert kicked that ball in behind, he's just so far ahead of the ball and he's just like goalkeeping, you know, and he's just like a sitting duck, you know. And I think you can have high line speed and you can have defensive pressure, but some of those decisions are bad, like they've gone way too far. Yeah. And when I said that Ireland have kind of held off now and they're trying to, you know, stop making decisions for defences, I think I've said it before, like the teams with the highest line speed, very easy to analyse, very hard to execute. But these top pro players obviously can execute, and Rob and McCluskey throwing the ball over the top, they obviously have that in their locker. But if you look at the back, the behind the goal shot of where Blair Kinghorn was, I don't know if any defensive coach is setting them up like that or just getting carried away with line speed. But it was a panic, like, wasn't it? I actually thought, because McCluskey carries a lot of ball in the midfield, if you're centres, you're kind of like hedging your bet a small, but you get caught a half a channel too narrow. But like, that's all well and good. They were never going to recover if Blair Kinghorn was up there already. Like, you know, there was nothing to recover to. So I think some of that is a bit mad. Like, the defence coaches maybe need to recalibrate on how much line speed they really want to put on, because that's just giving away your edges, like, isn't it?
Yeah, terrific defence. It's shocking. But that's what they're doing. So that's what I'm saying is I think there's going to be a real reevaluation of what they can do, and maybe be a little bit more passive, but give up a few yards, but not give up like a try from a set piece. It's crazy.
I think you can be passive in the set piece a bit more, because it can be analysed. If teams can see you repeatedly doing this, they'll find a way. They have time to talk about it, pick something and beat it. Whereas if you can kind of recalibrate, you know, get together, get them to an edge, and then line speed the whole team together when someone's not stuck in a scrum, fair enough. But like, going off on your own and set piece plays is easy to analyse, I think.
Very quickly, to put a bow on this podcast and the Six Nations, very quick thoughts. Moment of the championship for you?
It was Reece Carey's try. I like front rows galloping in for 20 yards. I think it was the moment Wales could see a bit of positivity.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the moment.
Johnny?
Very obvious one, but I can't get away from a kick to win the championship on the pitch in France, last play of the whole thing. Like, what a magic moment. I just felt like, you know, them kind of enveloping the pitch, and like, everyone was wanting Ireland to win it, and, you know, for France to miss a kick, I don't really agree with that. I like the game being won on the pitch by a kicker of that quality, and I think you can't beat the French crowd, everything they put on, Bernard riding the horse into the stadium and all of it. It was madness, like, wasn't it? So to have it won in an atmosphere like that, I think was absolutely magic.
For me, it was the single moment in Scotland France where Antoine Dupont runs in under his own post and throws a 5 meter pass forward. That was the moment. I was commentating on it for Against the Head, and I nearly had to stop myself swearing, saying, like, what the F have I just seen? So thankfully I didn't. But it was the moment where the crystallizing moment where you're going, oh my God, what is this Six Nations doing? This is incredible stuff. But look, we'll leave it there. That's what we'll do. A reminder, that's the men's Six Nations sorted. Women's Six Nations starts at Twickenham for Ireland on April 11th. URC is back in full this week. Connacht and Ulster picked up wins last week in their rearranged games. They meet on Friday night. Then on Saturday, Munster are away to the Sharks and Leinster visit Glasgow. Remember, sportpodcasts at rte.ie for your emails. And be creative as well. We want to see some. And we'll speak to you again soon on the RT Rugby Podcast.